The Marching Season, Disc 9.
Douglas Cannon's dinner party started out as an intimate gathering for 8, but in the aftermath of the Hartley Hall affair, it had metamorphosed into a catered bash for 50, with rented tables and chairs and a squad of college boys in blue jackets to park cars in the crammed streets of Georgetown. Such was the nature of celebrity in Washington. Douglas had lived and worked in the city for more than 20 years, but someone had tried to kill him, and that made him a star. The CIA and British intelligence had contributed to the ambassador's sudden notoriety by spinning a tale of Douglas's calm under fire at Hartley Hall, even though he was safely tucked in his bed at Winfield House by the time the assault began. Douglas had willingly played along with the elaborate ruse de guerre. Indeed, he derived a certain adolescent delight from deceiving the barons of the Washington media. The guests began arriving a few minutes after 7 o'clock. There were 2 of Douglas's old friends from the Senate and a handful of congressmen. The Washington bureau chief of NBC News came, along with her husband, who was the bureau chief of CNN. Cynthia Martin came alone. Adrian Carter brought his wife Christine. To protect Michael, who was still a clandestine member of the agency, Carter and Cynthia said they worked on Northern Ireland issues for the State Department. Carter wanted a moment alone with Michael, so they adjourned to the garden and stood by the pool. "How did things go with Bristol this morning?" Carter asked. "He seemed impressed with the product," Michael said. "Beckwith stuck his head in the door for a minute, too."
"Really?"
"He said he was pleased with the outcome of Operation Kettle Drum and that the peace process was back on track." "You're right, Adrian. He wants this thing bad." Michael hesitated. "So am I officially finished with Northern Ireland?" "When the delegations leave town, we'll turn it over to Cynthia and move you back to the Mideast section." "If there's one constant at the agency, it's change," Michael said. "But I still would like to know why Monica decided to shuffle the deck now, and why she wants me off the October case." "As far as Monica is concerned, the October file is closed. She thinks that even if October is still alive and working, he poses no threat to Americans or American interests, and therefore he does not cross the radar screen of the center." "Do you agree?" "Of course not, and I've told her as much. But she is the director, and ultimately she decides who we target." "A real man would resign in your position." "Some of us don't have the financial flexibility to take courageous moral stands, Michael." Elizabeth appeared at the French doors. "Would you two please come inside?" she said. "It's not as if you never get a chance to talk." "We'll be there in a minute," Michael said. "One other thing," Adrian said when Elizabeth had gone. "I heard about your little portrait session with Morton Dunn in OTS the other day. What the hell was that all about?" "A plastic surgeon named Maurice LaRue was murdered in Paris a couple of weeks ago." "And?" "I was wondering if October may have changed his face."
"And then killed the doctor who did it?"
"The thought had crossed my mind."
"Listen, Michael. Monica has taken you off the case. I don't want any more freelancing on your part. No surfing through files, no private operations. As far as you're concerned, October is dead."
"You're not threatening me, are you, Adrian?"
"Actually, I am."
Delaroche removed his headphones and lit a cigarette. The large dinner party had overwhelmed his microphone, so that the only thing he heard was a constant hum, interrupted by incomprehensible snatches of conversation or occasional bursts of laughter. He switched off the tape machine and removed his Beretta 9mm from its stainless steel carrying case. He broke down the weapon and meticulously wiped each piece with a smooth rag, while he decided how he was going to kill the ambassador and Michael Osborne. Thirty-seven. Washington.
"Happy St. Patrick's Day," President James Beckwith declared, as he stepped to the podium in the Rose Garden the following morning.
Flanking him were Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern and British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook. Behind the president were the leaders of the province's nationalist and unionist political parties, including Gerry Adams of Sinn Féin and David Trimble of the Ulster Unionist Party, who was now effectively the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland.
"We gather here today, not in crisis, but in celebration," Beckwith continued. "We celebrate the common heritage that binds us, and we will renew the commitment to peaceful change in Northern Ireland."
Douglas Cannon sat off to the side with a group of senior White House and State Department aides who would take part in the talks. He joined in the polite applause.
"Last month, a group of loyalist thugs, the so-called Ulster Freedom Brigade, tried to assassinate the American ambassador to Great Britain, my old friend and colleague Douglas Cannon," Beckwith continued. "It was truly the last gasp by those who wish to deal with Northern Ireland's problems with violence rather than compromise. If anyone doubts our commitment to peace, I ask them to consider one thing. Ambassador Douglas Cannon is here today, and the Ulster Freedom Brigade is but a bad memory."
Beckwith turned, smiled at Douglas, and began to applaud. Jerry Adams, David Trimble, Bertie Ahern, and Robin Cook joined in, as did the rest of the assembled crowd.
"Now, if you'll excuse us, we have work to do," Beckwith said. He turned away from the podium and, with arms extended, shepherded the politicians into the Oval Office, ignoring the shouted questions of the White House press corps.
When Douglas returned to the house on N Street late that afternoon, Michael and Elizabeth were waiting for him.
"How did it go?" Michael asked.
"Better than expected. Now that the Ulster Freedom Brigade has been neutralized, Jerry Adams thinks the IRA will seriously consider decommissioning."
"What does decommissioning mean?" Elizabeth asked.
"It means giving up their weapons and breaking up their terrorist cells and command structure."
Michael said the CIA estimates that the IRA alone has stockpiled 100 tons of rifles and 2.5 tons of Semtex.
"And then there are the Protestant terrorist groups. That's why it's so important to keep the momentum of the peace process moving in the right direction."
"The Protestants and the Catholics have made remarkable progress in a short period of time, but the peace process could very easily collapse. And if it does, I'm afraid the violence will be unprecedented."
Douglas looked at his watch.
"Now the fun begins. The Sinn Féin reception at the Mayflower, the Ulster Unionist reception at the Four Seasons, and the British reception at the Embassy."
"What the hell is that?" Elizabeth said as they changed clothes for the receptions.
"It's a high-powered Browning automatic with a 15-shot clip." Michael slipped the gun into a shoulder holster and pulled on his suit jacket.
"Why are you carrying a gun?"
"Because it makes me feel good.
Daddy is going to have a DSS agent with him the entire time tonight."
"You can never be too cautious."
"Is there something you're not telling me?"
"I'll just feel better when your father is back in London, surrounded by a bunch of Marines and special branch detectives who can hit an assassin between the eyes at 100 paces. He smoothed the front of his jacket. "How do I look?"
"Lovely."
She pulled on her dress and turned her back to him.
"Zip me up, we're late."
At the Embassy Row Hotel, Delaroche removed his headphones. He quickly broke down the monitors and receivers and placed them into the duffel bag. He slipped the Beretta 9mm into a shoulder holster and stood in front of the mirror, inspecting his appearance. He wore a gray, single-breasted business suit of American design, a white shirt, and a striped tie. Attached to his right ear was a clear plastic wire of the type used by security officers the world over. He studied his face, staring into his own eyes, and said, "Diplomatic security, ma'am. We have an emergency." It was the flat American accent of the actor on the English-language tapes Delaroche had studied at sea. He repeated the phrase several more times until he felt completely at ease. Rebecca emerged from the bathroom. She wore a tailored 2-piece suit and black stockings. Delaroche handed her a loaded Beretta and 2 extra clips, which she slipped into a black shoulder bag. He had left the Volvo on 22nd Street just off Massachusetts Avenue. There was a parking ticket beneath the wiper. Delaroche dropped the ticket in the gutter and climbed behind the wheel. The limousine stopped in front of the Mayflower Hotel on Connecticut Avenue. A uniformed doorman opened the door, and Douglas, Michael, Elizabeth, and a DSS agent climbed out. They entered the hotel and walked along the ornate center hall to the grand ballroom. Jerry Adams caught sight of Douglas as he entered the room and disentangled himself from a knot of star-struck Irish-American well-wishers.
"Thank you for coming, Ambassador Cannon." Adams spoke with the thick accent of West Belfast.
He was tall, with a full black beard and wire-rimmed spectacles. Although he appeared robust, he suffered from the lingering effects of years of imprisonment and an assassination attempt by the UVF that nearly killed him.
"You do us a great honor by joining us this evening."
"Thank you for having us," Douglas said politely, shaking Adams's hand. "May I introduce my daughter, Elizabeth Osborne, and her husband, Michael Osborne?"
Adams looked at Michael briefly and shook his hand without enthusiasm. As he and Douglas talked about that day's session at the White House for a few moments, Elizabeth and Michael moved a few steps away to give them privacy. Then, without warning, Jerry Adams placed a hand on Michael's shoulder and said, "You mind if I have a wee word with you, Mr. Osborne? I'm afraid it's rather important." Delaroche parked at the corner of Prospect and Potomac Streets in Georgetown and climbed out. Rebecca slid behind the wheel and lowered the window. Delaroche leaned down and asked, "Any questions?" Rebecca shook her head. Delaroche handed her an envelope. "If something goes wrong, if something happens to me or if we get separated, go to this place. I'll come for you if I can." He turned away and entered a sandwich shop filled with students from Georgetown. He purchased coffee and a newspaper and sat down at a table by the window. A moment later, he saw Rebecca speed past, heading east toward downtown Washington.
"Please sit down, Mr. Osborne," Jerry Adams said.
He had led Michael into a large room adjoining the grand ballroom. His pair of ever-present bodyguards moved out of earshot. Adams poured two cups of tea.
"Milk, Mr. Osborne."
"Thank you."
"I have a message from your friend Seamus Devlin."
"Seamus Devlin is not my friend," Michael said harshly.
The bodyguards glanced at the table to make certain there was no problem. Jerry Adams waved them away.
"I know what happened that night in Belfast," he said, "and I know why it happened. We would never be in this position today on the verge of a lasting peace in Northern Ireland if it weren't for the IRA. It is a highly professional farce not to be taken lightly. Keep that in mind next time you and your British friends try to plant a tout on the inside."
"I thought you had a message for me."
"It's about that bitch that set up Eamon Dillon on the Falls Road, Rebecca Wells."
"What about her?"
"She went to Paris after the Hartley Hall affair."
Adams raised his china teacup in a mock toast and said, "Lovely piece of work that was, Mr. Osborne." Michael remained silent.
"She was living in Montparnasse with a Scottish mercenary named Roderick Campbell. According to Devlin, she and Campbell were in the market for a freelance assassin to finish the job on your father-in-law."
Michael sat up sharply. "How good is the source?"
"I didn't get into that kind of detail with Devlin, Mr. Osborne, but you've seen his work up close. He's not a man who goes about his business lightly."
"Where's Rebecca Wells now?"
"She left Paris suddenly a couple of weeks ago. Devlin hasn't been able to pick up her trail again."
"What about Roderick Campbell?"
"Gone too. Permanently, I'm afraid. He was shot to death in his apartment along with a girl."
Adams was clearly enjoying telling Michael something he didn't know.
"It probably didn't cross your sophisticated computer screens at the Counterterrorism Center."
"Did Wells and Campbell ever manage to hire a shooter?"
"Devlin doesn't know. But I wouldn't let down the guard on the ambassador right now, if you know what I mean. It would be bad for everyone involved in the peace process if a gunman acting on behalf of the Ulster Freedom Brigade managed to kill your father-in-law this time."
Adams set down his teacup, signaling the meeting was coming to an end.
"Devlin hopes this makes up for any hard feelings you might have about Kevin Maguire."
"You can tell Devlin to fuck off."
Adams smiled.
"I'll give him the message."
Rebecca Wells sat behind the wheel of the Volvo, a half block from the front entrance of the Mayflower. She watched as Ambassador Cannon and the Osbornes emerged from the hotel, followed by the DSS agent. She started the engine, then dialed a number on her cellular phone.
"Yes?"
"They're leaving the first stop now and moving on to the second." The line went dead. Rebecca dropped the Volvo into gear and slipped into the evening traffic on Connecticut Avenue.
"When did you and Jerry become such good friends?" Elizabeth asked.
"We move in similar circles."
"What did he want?"
"He apologized for what happened to me in Belfast."
"Did you accept?"
"Not really."
"And that's all?"
"That's all."
Douglas said, "All right, time to cross the religious divide to the Four Seasons for drinks with the Protestants."
"You think these people will ever have receptions together?" Elizabeth asked.
"I wouldn't hold your breath," Michael said.
90 minutes later, Rebecca Wells was parked along a tree-lined section of Massachusetts Avenue in upper northwest Washington. Across the street was the sprawling British Embassy complex. From her vantage point, she could see the forecourt of the ambassador's residence. The first guests were beginning to leave. Rebecca opened the letter that Delaroche had given her and read it by the faint light of the street lamps. She folded the note and placed it back in her pocket. She thought of that freezing afternoon on the beach in Norfolk, the afternoon she had left for Scotland to fetch Gavin Spencer and the guns. It was hard to imagine that it was only a month ago, so much had happened since. She remembered the strange sense of serenity that had settled over her that day, walking the flat, desolate beach. She had wanted to stay there forever. And now this man with no past, this hired killer who made love to her as if her body were made of glass, was offering her a sanctuary by the sea. She looked up in time to see Douglas Cannon and the Osbournes leaving the British ambassador's residence. Once again she punched in the number on her cell phone and waited for the voice of the man she knew only as Jean-Paul. Delaroche severed the connection with Rebecca Wells and left the sandwich shop. He walked quickly north along Potomac Street until he reached N Street. The Osbournes' house was two blocks away. He moved more slowly now, strolling along the quiet street, instinctively looking for signs of additional security. He had to time his arrival perfectly. The DSS agent accompanying Douglas Cannon would radio his team to alert them of the ambassador's imminent arrival. If the DSS agent received no reply, he would suspect there was a problem. Which is why Delaroche was taking his time walking along N Street. He spotted the team of DSS agents sitting in a parked car in front of the Osbournes' house with the front windows opened. One of them, the one behind the wheel, was talking on a handheld radio. Delaroche assumed he was talking to the agent in the ambassador's limousine. Delaroche walked to the car and stood next to the driver's side window. "Excuse me," he said. "Which way is Wisconsin Avenue?" The agent behind the wheel wordlessly pointed east. "Thank you," Delaroche said. Then he reached beneath his raincoat, withdrew the silenced Beretta, and shot each of the agents several times in the chest. He opened the door and pushed the bodies down onto the seat. He closed the power windows, removed the keys, shut the door, and locked it. The entire thing had taken less than 30 seconds. He tossed the car keys into the darkness and crossed the street to the Osbournes' house. He climbed the steps and rang the bell, breathing deeply to steady his nerves. A moment later he heard footsteps approaching the door. "Who's there?" It was the English-accented voice of Maggie, the nanny.
"Diplomatic security, ma'am," Delaroche said. "I'm afraid we have an emergency."
The door opened and Maggie stood there, face perplexed.
"What's wrong?"
Delaroche stepped inside the house and closed the door. He clasped Maggie's mouth in an iron grip, smothering her scream, and pulled her face close to his. With his free hand, he reached inside his suit jacket and removed the Beretta, pressing the end of the silencer into her cheek.
"I know there are children in this house, and I mean them no harm," he whispered in his accented English, "but if you don't do exactly as I say, I'll shoot you in the face. Do you understand me?"
Maggie nodded, eyes wide with terror.
"All right. Come upstairs with me."
The evening had gone off without incident, just as Michael had expected. But as the car sped along Massachusetts Avenue, the warning from Jerry Adams rang in his ears. If Rebecca Wells had managed to hire an assassin, it posed a new and different threat to Douglas's safety.
An assassin working alone would be much more difficult to identify and stop than a member of a known paramilitary organization. Michael decided he would tell Douglas the news when they arrived home. His activities and appearances in London would have to be restricted until the threat had passed, or until Rebecca Wells could be arrested. The car turned onto Wisconsin Avenue, and they headed south into Georgetown. Elizabeth leaned her head on Michael's shoulder and closed her eyes. Douglas laid a hand on Michael's forearm and said, "You know, Michael, there is something I never did that I need to do now. I never thanked you." "What are you talking about?" "I never thanked you for saving my life. If you hadn't taken on this case, gone into Northern Ireland and risked your life, I might very well be dead right now. Obviously, I've never had an opportunity to see you do your job before. You are a superb intelligence officer." "Thank you, Douglas. Coming from an old spook-hating liberal like you, that means a lot to me." "Are you going to stay on with the agency now that the Northern Ireland business is over?" "If my wife promises not to divorce me," Michael said, "Monica Tyler wants me to take the Sword of Gaza case again. The agency has picked up some indications the group may be planning new attacks."
"What kind of indications?"
"Movement of known action agents, communications intercepts, that sort of thing."
"Anything in Britain?"
"The UK is always a possibility. They like operating there."
"I remember the Heathrow attack."
"So do I," Michael said. Douglas sat back and closed his eyes as the car left Wisconsin Avenue and slipped through the quiet residential streets of Georgetown.
"When is it going to end?" he said.
"When is what going to end?"
"Terrorism. The taking of innocent life to make a political statement. When is it going to end?"
"When there are no more people in the world who feel oppressed enough to pick up a gun or a bomb. When there are no more religious or ethnic zealots. When there are no more maniacs who get their kicks by shedding blood."
"So I guess the answer to my question is never. It will never end."
"You're the historian. In the first century, the zealots used terrorism to fight the Roman occupation of the Promised Land. In the 12th century, a group of Shiite Muslims called the Assassins used terrorism against the Sunni leaders of Persia. It's hardly a new phenomenon."
"And now it's come to America. The World Trade Center, Oklahoma City, Olympic Park."
"It's cheap, it's relatively easy, and it only takes a handful of dedicated individuals. Two men named Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols proved that."
"It's still incomprehensible to me," Douglas said. 168 people gone in the blink of an eye."
"All right, you two," Elizabeth said, opening her eyes as the car braked to a halt in front of the house. "Enough of this conversation. You're depressing me." Delaroche was standing on the second floor of the house in a window overlooking N Street when he heard the sound of a car. He parted the curtain with the silencer of the Beretta and peered down into the street. It was Cannon and the Osbournes arriving home. He released the curtain and walked down the hall to the staircase, glancing into the master bedroom as he moved past the door. The nanny lay on the floor, her hands, feet, and mouth bound by packing tape. Delaroche moved quickly down the stairs and stood in the darkened center hall. It was going to be so easy, he thought, like a shooting game at a carnival, and then he would be done with it. All of it. 38. Washington. Rebecca Wells turned onto N Street and followed the limousine for two blocks until it came to a stop. There were no spaces in front of the Osbournes' house, so the driver simply parked in the middle of the street and switched on the hazard lights. Rebecca reached into her shoulder bag and withdrew the silenced Beretta 9mm. Jean-Paul's instructions ran through her head. "I'll take care of the two men in the car and then go inside the house," he had told her the previous night, speaking softly beneath the screaming television in their hotel room. "Wait until they're all out of the car. You kill the last DSS man, and I'll take care of the ambassador and Michael Osborne." She wondered whether she had the strength to do it. And then she thought of Gavin Spencer and Kyle Blake and the men who had died at Hartley Hall because Michael Osborne and his father-in-law had deceived her. She checked the action on the Beretta and chambered the first round. One of the limousine's doors opened, and a DSS agent climbed out. He walked around the back of the car and pulled open the rear door facing the Osborne's house. Michael Osborne came out first. He glanced around the street, his gaze settling on the Volvo for an instant before moving on. The ambassador emerged, followed by Elizabeth Osborne. Rebecca opened her door. Michael turned to the DSS man and said, "Where are the other agents?" The DSS agent raised his hand to his mouth and murmured a few words. When he received no response, he yelled, "Get back into the car, now!" It was then that Rebecca Wells stepped out of the Volvo. She stood, arms braced on the roof of the car, and started firing at the DSS agent, one shot after another, just as Jean-Paul had told her. Michael did not hear the shots, only the shattering of the limousine's rear window and the thud of the 9mm rounds piercing the trunk. Instead of obeying the DSS agent's instructions to get into the car, Michael, Elizabeth, and Douglas had instinctively fallen to the pavement of N Street. Michael suspected there was something wrong about the woman in the Volvo station wagon, but he had been too slow to seize upon the possibility that it might actually be Rebecca Wells. Now, as he crouched over Elizabeth and Douglas, the final seconds of the DSS agent's life flashed through his mind. The agent had tried to raise the other men, but could not. That's because someone else has already killed them, Michael thought. Then he thought of the information Jerry Adams had given him earlier that night. Rebecca Wells had been looking for a professional assassin to kill Douglas. Her hired killer was probably somewhere close. Michael pulled out the Browning automatic. The driver was still behind the wheel of the limousine, ducking for cover below the top of the seat. Michael grabbed Elizabeth and Douglas and said, "Get into the car!" Elizabeth crawled into the back seat. One of the shots struck the DSS man in the head, sending a shower of blood and brain tissue through the shattered rear window. Elizabeth looked at Michael helplessly and tried to wipe the blood from her face. Then her eyes grew suddenly wide and she screamed, "Michael, behind you!" Michael turned and saw a figure standing high atop the curved steps leading to the entrance of the house. The man's right arm swung up, and he fired twice, one-handed, his silenced weapon emitting no sound, just a tongue of fire from the end of the barrel. Even in the dim light of Georgetown, Michael knew he had seen that distinctive handling of a gun before. The man on his front steps was October. The first shot ricocheted off the roof of the car. The second struck Douglas in the back as he lunged into the car. He collapsed onto Elizabeth, groaning in pain. Michael pointed his gun at October and fired several shots, driving him back into the house. On the quiet street, the high-powered Browning sounded like artillery. "Go, go!" he screamed at the driver. "Get them out of here!" The driver sat up and gunned the engine. The last thing Michael saw was Elizabeth screaming through the shattered rear window. "The children, Michael!" she cried. "The children!" Michael dived between two parked cars, where he was shielded from Rebecca Wells and October at least for a few seconds. He peered upward toward the entrance of the house and saw October emerge. Michael aimed the Browning and fired several shots. October ducked back inside. Then windows in the cars around him started to shatter. The woman was firing at him. Lights had come on all along the street. Michael turned and saw Rebecca Wells standing behind the open door of the Volvo station wagon, firing across the roof. He pivoted and thought about returning her fire. He realized that if he missed, a stray round could enter one of the neighboring homes and kill an innocent person who had come out to see what was going on. He aimed at his own house. He thought, "Please God, let the children be upstairs in the nursery." And then he fired at October until his gun was empty. Michael heard the first siren as he was changing his clip. Perhaps it was the gunfire, Michael thought, or perhaps the DSS man had managed to flash an alert before he was killed. Whatever the case, Michael could now hear the wail of several approaching sirens, growing louder with each passing second. October appeared in the doorway, waving to Rebecca. "Go!" he yelled. "Get away from here!" The first police cruiser appeared on N Street. October fired two wild shots at the car. "Now, Rebecca, leave!" Michael chambered the first round of his fresh clip and fired four shots at October. With that, Rebecca Wells climbed into the Volvo and gunned the engine, roaring past the spot where Michael had taken cover. October stepped onto the porch one last time and fired several shots in Michael's direction, then turned and ran into the house. Michael rose and followed after him, pounding up the steps, the Browning in his outstretched hands. When he reached the doorway, he peered down the darkened center hall and saw October lift a chair and hurl it through the French doors. October turned one last time and raised his gun. Michael heard nothing but saw the muzzle spouting fire. He leaned against the exterior of the house. On the other side of the wall, he could feel the rounds crashing into the plasterwork. When the gunfire stopped, Michael stepped into the doorway and fired three more shots as October ran across the garden and scaled the fence. Michael ran upstairs to the nursery and found the children crying in their cribs unharmed. "Maggie?" He heard thumping in the master bedroom and muffled screams. He ran down the hall and turned on the lights in the bedroom. Maggie lay on the floor, bound and gagged. "Was there just one, Maggie? Just one gunman?" She nodded. "I'll be right back." Michael charged down the stairs just as a Metropolitan Police officer entered the house, gun drawn. He aimed his weapon at Michael and yelled, "Stop right there and drop your gun." "I'm Michael Osborne, and this is my house." "I don't care who the fuck you are, just drop the gun, now!" "God damn it, I'm Ambassador Cannon's son-in-law, and I work for the CIA. Put the fucking gun down." The officer kept his gun aimed at Michael's head. "My father-in-law was hit," Michael said. "Both shooters have fled, a man on foot and a woman in a black Volvo station wagon. My children are upstairs with their nanny. Go help her, I'll be right back." "Hey, come back here!" the officer yelled as Michael ran down the center hall and vanished through the shattered French doors. Delaroche did not come to Washington to get into a gunfight with Michael Osborne. Anyone could be hit when bullets are flying around a small space, and Delaroche was unwilling to trade his life for Osborne's. Besides, he had hit the primary target, Ambassador Cannon, with a good shot in the back. With a little luck, the wound would prove fatal. Still, he was angry about failing to kill Osborne once again. He stripped off the tan raincoat as he sprinted down the alley. When he reached 34th Street, he stepped directly into the path of an oncoming car, a light gray Saab with a college student behind the wheel. Delaroche raised his Beretta and aimed it through the windshield. "Get the fuck out of the car." The student climbed out with his hands raised and stepped aside. "Take it, motherfucker, it's yours." "Run," Delaroche said, waving the Beretta, and the student started running. Delaroche climbed behind the wheel. The student screamed, "Fuck you, you fucking asshole!" Delaroche drove off. He knew he had to get out of Georgetown quickly. He raced down 34th Street toward M Street. If he could cross the Francis Scott Key Bridge to Arlington, his chances of escape would increase dramatically. There he could slip onto the George Washington Parkway, I-395, or I-66, and be miles from Washington in a matter of minutes. At M Street, the traffic signal turned from green to red as Delaroche approached. A sign warned no right turn on red. He considered running the light, but calmness during escapes had always served him well in the past, and he decided not to act rashly now. He applied the brakes and came to a stop. He looked at his wristwatch and counted the seconds. As Michael Osborne leaped over the fence into the alley, he heard a man shouting obscenities. A split second later, he heard tires screeching and the engine of a small car revving. By the sound of it, Michael guessed the car was heading toward M Street. He also guessed that it was October trying to escape. He sprinted down 33rd Street to M Street, turned right, and kept running. Delaroche spotted Osborne running along M Street with a gun in his hand, scattering startled pedestrians. Delaroche slowly turned and looked straight ahead, waiting for the light to turn green. The Beretta lay on the passenger seat. Delaroche wrapped his right hand around the grip and placed his finger across the trigger. He thought, "Perhaps I'll get an opportunity to fulfill the terms of the contract after all." Osborne arrived in the intersection. He stood in the crosswalk, directly in front of the Saab, gun in hand, staring up 34th Street. He was breathing heavily, eyes flickering back and forth. Delaroche lifted the Beretta slowly and laid it on his lap. He considered shooting Osborne through the windshield, but decided against it. Even if he did manage to hit Osborne, he would be left with a damaged car for his escape. He reached out with his left hand and pressed a button on the armrest, lowering his window as the light turned green. Several other cars had pulled up behind him, and the drivers were honking their horns, not realizing that there was a man with a gun standing in the middle of the intersection. Delaroche sat motionless, waiting for Osborne to make his move. Michael stood in the intersection, heart pounding, ignoring the cacophony of car horns. He checked the faces inside every car, a 40-something suit in a light gray Saab, a pair of rich students in a red BMW, a couple of Georgetown patricians in a rattling diesel Mercedes, a Pizza Hut delivery boy. Everyone was honking except for the man in the Saab. Michael looked at him carefully. He was rather ugly, heavy cheeks, a blunt chin, a broad, flat nose. Michael had seen the face somewhere before but couldn't figure out where. He stared at him while the faces of his past appeared in his mind one by one, like images on a screen, some clear and sharp, some unfocused and scratchy. Then he realized where he had seen the man before, on Morton Dunn's computer screen at OTS. Michael aimed the Browning at October's face. "Get out of the car! Now!" 39. Washington. The vast intersection at the base of Key Bridge is one of the most congested and chaotic in all of Washington. Traffic from the towering bridge, M Street, and the Whitehurst Freeway all converge at the same point. During the morning and evening rush hours, the intersection is jammed with commuter traffic. At night, it is filled with cars streaming into the restaurants and nightclubs of Georgetown. Above it all stand the black stone steps made infamous by The Exorcist, sad, covered in graffiti, stinking of urine from drunken Georgetown students who consider taking a piss there a rite of passage. None of this entered Delaroche's mind, however, as he sat behind the wheel of the Saab staring down the barrel of Michael Osborne's Browning automatic. When he ordered him out of the car, Delaroche pressed the accelerator to the floor and leaned down. Michael fired several shots through the windshield as the car raced forward, then he dived out of the way as the Saab careened into the intersection. Delaroche sat up behind the wheel, regained control, and raced toward the entrance of Key Bridge. Michael rolled away from the oncoming car and rose onto one knee. He took aim at the back of the Saab as it moved swiftly away from him, shutting out the blaring of car horns. He had 8 rounds left in the Browning and no backup clip. He fired all 8 shots before Delaroche could make the turn onto the bridge. 7 tore through the trunk and embedded in the rear seat. The 8th hit the fuel tank, and the Saab exploded. Delaroche heard the explosion and instantly felt the heat of the burning gasoline. Cars screeched to a halt around him. A young man in a redskin sweatshirt ran to Delaroche's aid. Delaroche aimed the Beretta at his head, and the man in the sweatshirt fled toward Francis Scott Key Park. Delaroche leaped out of the car and saw Michael Osborne running toward him. He raised the Beretta and fired 3 times. Michael Osborne dived behind a parked car. Delaroche started toward Key Bridge, but a car, seemingly oblivious of the burning vehicle in the center of the intersection, sped toward him. Delaroche leaped just before impact and tumbled over the windshield. He lost his grip on the Beretta, and it clattered into the path of the oncoming traffic. Delaroche looked up and saw Michael Osborne running toward him. He stood and tried to run, but his right ankle buckled and he collapsed onto the asphalt. He struggled to his feet and willed himself forward. His ankle felt as though there were broken glass just beneath the skin. He managed to reach the sidewalk of Key Bridge. A man stood there watching the spectacle, holding the handlebars of a poor-quality mountain bike. Delaroche punched the man in the throat and took the bike. He climbed onto the saddle and tried to pedal, but when he exerted force with his right foot, the pain made him scream. He pedaled with one leg, his left leg, while his right simply rode up and down with the rotation of the cranks. He turned and looked over his shoulder. Michael Osborne was running toward him. Delaroche pedaled faster, but between his broken ankle and the poor quality of the bike, Osborne was gaining on him. Delaroche felt utterly defenseless. He had no weapon and a rattle-trap bicycle for transport. To make matters worse, he was injured. More than anything else, Delaroche suddenly felt rage. Rage at his father and Vladimir and everyone else at the KGB who had condemned him to a life of killing. Rage in himself for allowing the director to force him into this assignment. Rage in himself for failing once again to kill Osborne.
He wondered how Osborne had known it was him behind the wheel of the Saab. Had Maurice Leroux betrayed him before he killed him that night in Paris? Had the director betrayed him? Or had he once again underestimated the intelligence and ingenuity of the man from the CIA, the man who had sworn to destroy him? That it would all end like this, with Delaroche on a creaking bike and Osborne chasing him on foot, was almost laughable. He realized that even if he managed to get away from Osborne now, his chances of going very far were growing slimmer by the minute. He turned and looked once more and saw that Osborne had gained more ground. He forced himself to pedal with both legs, ignoring the pain in his ankle, while he decided what he was willing to do to get off the bridge alive. Michael slipped the Browning back into the shoulder holster and sprinted across the bridge, pumping hard with his arms. For an instant, he was transported back to the Virginia State Finals of the mile. Michael had made a brilliant tactical move in the final lap to place himself in perfect position to overtake the leader in the final 100 yards, but when they reached the home stretch, he had not had the courage to endure the pain necessary to win. He had become virtually hypnotized by the other boy's back, the fluttering of his jersey in the wind, the lean muscles of his shoulders as he pulled farther and farther away and broke the tape. And he remembered his father, so furious that Michael had lost that he wouldn't even console him after the race. He had closed to within 10 yards of October. He had run nearly a mile since dashing from the house. His legs were heavy, his muscles tight from the prolonged sprint. His arms burned, and his throat tasted of rust and blood from gasping for air. He had been pursuing October for years, using all the resources and technical services the agency had to offer, but it all came down to this, a mind-bending sprint across Key Bridge. This time he was not going to shy away from the pain. This time he was not going to be hypnotized by his opponent's back, pulling farther and farther away. His head leaned back and he roared like a wounded animal, thrashing at the air with his hands as if trying to pull himself forward. October was now just a few feet away. Michael leaped and rode him to the ground with a heavy crash. October landed on his back, Michael on top of him, sitting on his abdomen. Michael punched him twice in the face, the second blow splitting the flesh high on Delaroche's cheekbone, then grabbed his throat with both hands and began to strangle him. He had lost all sense of reason and sanity. He was squeezing October's throat, crushing his windpipe, screaming at him savagely. Yet a strange calmness had come over the assassin's face. His blue eyes flickered over Michael, and a vague half-smile appeared on his lips. Michael realized October was deciding how best to kill him. He squeezed harder. October reached up suddenly and seized Michael's hair with his left hand. He pulled Michael's head toward him and drove the thumb of his right hand into Michael's eye socket. Michael screamed in agony and released his grip on October's throat. The assassin turned his hands to hatchets and struck Michael simultaneously twice on the temples. Michael nearly lost consciousness. He shook his head, trying to clear his vision, then realized that he was on his back, and the assassin had slipped away from him. Michael struggled to his feet. October was already standing, feet apart, hands near his face, eyes fastened on Michael's. He spun and delivered a vicious roundhouse kick to the side of Michael's head. Michael stumbled from the sidewalk onto the roadbed of the bridge, directly into the path of a speeding metro bus. The driver leaned on the horn. Michael leaped out of the way into the arms of October. The assassin crouched, and using Michael's momentum, lifted him over the railing. Delaroche waited for the sound of Michael's body hitting the water more than 100 feet below. But there was nothing. He stepped forward and looked down. Michael had managed to grab hold of the base of the railing with one hand on his way down, and now he was dangling over the water. Michael looked up, blood in his mouth, and stared at Delaroche. The easiest thing to do would be to stomp on his hand until he lost his grip. But for some reason the idea was abhorrent to Delaroche. He had always killed silently and swiftly, appearing from nowhere and vanishing again. Killing a man in this manner seemed somehow barbaric to him. He leaned down and said, "Let me go, and I will help you."
Fuck you, Michael said, grimacing. That's not terribly wise on your part. Delaroche reached down through the railing and took hold of Michael's left wrist. Reach up and take my hand. Michael was beginning to lose his grip on the railing. You just killed my father-in-law, he said. You tried to kill me and my wife. You killed Sarah. I didn't kill them, Michael. Other people killed them. I was just the weapon. I'm not responsible for their deaths any more than you are responsible for the death of Astrid Vogel. Who hired you? Michael rasped. It doesn't matter. It matters to me. Who hired you? But Michael's grip was beginning to weaken. Delaroche took hold of his left arm with both hands. Michael reached into his jacket with his right hand, withdrew the Browning, and aimed it at Delaroche's head. Delaroche held on to Michael's hand, staring at the gun. Then he smiled and said, Do you know the story of the frog and the scorpion crossing the Nile? Michael knew the parable. Anyone who had ever lived or worked in the Middle East knew it. A frog and a scorpion are standing on the banks of the Nile, and the scorpion asks the frog to ferry him to the other side. The frog refuses because he is afraid the scorpion will sting him. The scorpion assures the frog he will not sting him. To do so would be foolish, because then both of them would drown. The frog sees the logic of this statement and agrees to take the scorpion to the other side. When they reach the middle of the river, the scorpion stings the frog. Now we both will drown, the frog cries, as his body goes numb with the scorpion's venom. Why did you do that? The scorpion smiles and says, Because this is the Middle East. I know the story, Michael said. We have been locked in this conflict for too many years. Perhaps we can help each other. Revenge is for savages, after all. I understand you were in Northern Ireland recently. Look at what revenge has done for that place. What do you want? I will tell you what you want to know most. Who hired me to kill Douglas Cannon? Who hired me to kill the conspirators in the transatlantic affair? Who hired me to kill you because you knew too much? He paused. I will also tell you about the person in your organization who is involved with these people. In exchange, you will provide me with protection and allow me access to my bank accounts. I don't have the authority to make a deal like that. Perhaps not the authority, but you have the ability. Michael remained silent. Delaroche said, You don't want to die without knowing the truth, do you, Michael? Fuck you! Do we have a deal? How do you know I won't have you arrested the minute you pull me up? Because, unfortunately, you are an honorable man, which makes you strangely ill-suited to a business like this. Delaroche shook Michael and said, Do we have a deal? We have a deal, you fucking bastard. All right, then. Drop the gun into the river and take my hand before you get us both killed. 40. Washington, Dulles International Airport. The bullet broke several of Ambassador Cannon's ribs and collapsed his left lung, said the doctor at George Washington University Hospital, an absurdly young-looking surgeon named Carlyle. But unless he suffers some serious complications, I think he's going to be all right. Can I see him? Elizabeth said. Carlyle shook his head. He's in recovery now, and frankly, he doesn't look great. Why don't you stay here and try to make yourself comfortable? We'll let you see him as soon as he's awake. The doctor went out. Elizabeth tried to sit down, but after a few minutes she was once again pacing the small private waiting room. Two Metropolitan Police officers stood guard outside the door. She wore a set of light blue hospital scrubs because her dress had been stained with the blood of her father and the DSS agent. Maggie and the children were in a separate room. Maggie was remarkable, Elizabeth thought. She had been threatened by an assassin and bound with packing tape, but she refused to let the nurses look after Liza and Jake. Now Elizabeth needed just one thing. She needed to hear her husband's voice. It had been more than an hour since Elizabeth's nightmarish escape from N Street. The police had told her what they knew. When the first units arrived, the terrorist had fled and Michael was alive. Then he disappeared across the back garden and no one had seen him since. 2 minutes later, there was gunfire on the Georgetown side of Key Bridge, and a car exploded.
The car, a light gray Saab, had been stolen a moment earlier by a man with a silenced handgun. There were also reports of two men fighting on the bridge, one man dangling over the water. Elizabeth closed her eyes and shivered. She thought, "Michael, if you're alive, please tell me." It was 11 o'clock. She switched on the television and flipped through the channels. The story was everywhere, the local stations and all the cable news channels. No one had any news about Michael. She dug a cigarette from her purse and lit it, smoking while she paced. A nurse came by and stuck her head in the door. "I'm sorry, ma'am, but there's no smoking in here." Elizabeth looked for a place to put the cigarette. "Let me take that, Mrs. Osborne," the nurse said gently. "Is there anything I can get you?" Elizabeth shook her head. As the nurse went out, her cellular phone rang. She pulled the phone from her bag and switched it on. "Hello? It's me, Elizabeth. Don't say a word. Just listen."
"Michael,"
she whispered. "I'm fine," he said. "I haven't been hurt."
"Thank God," she said.
"How's Douglas?"
"He's out of surgery. The doctor thinks he's going to be all right."
"Where are the children?"
"They're here at the hospital," Elizabeth said. "When am I going to see you?"
"Maybe tomorrow. I have something I need to do first. I love you, Elizabeth."
"Michael, where are you?" she asked.
But the line had already gone dead. Rebecca Wells left the Volvo in the long-term lot at Dulles Airport and took a shuttle bus to the terminal. She dropped the keys into a trash can and went into a restroom. She entered a stall and changed clothes, trading her two-piece suit for faded jeans, a sweater, and suede cowboy boots. Finally, she pinned her hair against her head and put on a blonde wig. She looked at herself in the mirror. The transformation had taken less than 5 minutes. She was now Sally Burke of Los Angeles, with a passport and a California driver's license to prove it. She walked through the terminal to the Air Mexico counter and checked in for the late flight to Mexico City. The next 72 hours were going to be difficult. From Mexico, she would travel through Central and South America, changing passports and identities each day. Then she would board a plane in Buenos Aires and go back to Europe. She sat down in the lounge at the gate and waited for the flight to be called. She tried to close her eyes, but each time she did, she saw the head of the DSS agent explode in a flash of blood. The CNN Airport Channel was running a news bulletin on the assassination attempt. "The Ulster Freedom Brigade has just claimed responsibility for the attempted murder of Ambassador Douglas Cannon. His two assailants, a man and a woman, are still at large. Doctors at George Washington University Hospital in Washington say Cannon is in critical condition, but his wounds are not life-threatening." Rebecca looked away. She thought, "Where in God's name are you, Jean-Paul?" She removed the letter he had given her 4 hours earlier and read it once more. "Go to this place. I'll come for you if I can." The flight was called. She tossed the letter into a trash can and walked to the gate. 41. Washington. "What should I call you?"
"I use many names, but I was called Jean-Paul Delaroche for the longest, and so I think of myself as him."
"So I'm to call you Delaroche?"
"If you wish," Delaroche said, and pulled his lips down into a frown that was very French.
Despite the late hour, there still was a good deal of traffic on the Capitol Beltway, the remnants of Washington's eternal evening rush. Michael turned onto Interstate 95 and headed north toward Baltimore. The car was a rented Ford, which Michael had collected from National Airport after fleeing Key Bridge in a taxicab. At first, the driver had refused to open the door to a pair of men in suits who looked as though someone had just beaten the daylights out of them. Then Delaroche flashed a stack of 20s, and the driver said that if they wanted to go to the moon, he would get them there by morning. Delaroche was seated in the front passenger seat, foot propped on the dash. He was rubbing his ankle and scowling at it, as if it had betrayed him. He carelessly lit yet another cigarette. If he was anxious or afraid, he showed no signs of it. He cracked the window to release the cloud of smoke. The inside of the car suddenly stank of wet farmland.
For years after Sarah's murder, Michael had tried to picture her killer in his mind. He supposed he had imagined that he was bigger than he actually was. Indeed, Delaroche was rather small and compact, with the tightly wound muscles of a welterweight. Michael had heard his voice once before, at Cannon Point, the night he had tried to kill him, but listening to him speak now, Michael understood that he was not one man, but many. His accent drifted about the map of Europe. Sometimes it was French, sometimes German, sometimes Dutch or Greek. He never spoke like a Russian. Michael wondered if at this point he could even speak his native language. By the way, the gun was empty. Delaroche sighed heavily, as if he were bored by a tedious television program. The standard-issue handgun for CIA officers is a high-powered Browning automatic with a 15-shot clip, he said. After reloading, you fired 3 shots at me through the front door, 4 through the windshield, and 8 into the back of the Saab. If you knew the gun was empty, why didn't you just drop me from the bridge? Because even if I had killed you, I had almost no chance of escape. I was wounded, I had no gun, no vehicle, and no communications. You were the only weapon I had left. What the fuck are you talking about? I have something you want, and you have something I want. You want to know who hired me to kill you, and I want protection from my enemy so I can live in peace. What makes you think I intend to live up to that bargain? Men don't quit the CIA unless they have principles. And men don't come back to the CIA when their president asks them unless they believe in honor. Your honor is your weak point. Why did you choose this life anyway, Michael? Was it your father who drove you to it? So, Michael thought, Delaroche has spent as much time analyzing me as I have him. I don't think I would have made the same decision if the roles were reversed, Michael said. I think I would have let you fall from the bridge and enjoyed the sight of your body floating down the river. That's not something to boast about. You are virtuous, but you are also highly emotional, and that makes you easily manipulated. The KGB understood that when they placed Sarah Randolph in your path and when they ordered me to kill her in front of your eyes. Fuck you, Michael said. He was tempted to stop the car and beat the hell out of Delaroche. Then he remembered the fight on the bridge and how easily Delaroche had nearly killed him with his bare hands. Michael, please slow down before you kill us both. Where are we going, by the way? What happened to your face? Michael said, ignoring Delaroche's question. You issued an Interpol alert along with a computer composite of my face, so I had plastic surgery. How did you learn about the alert? One thing at a time, Michael. Was the plastic surgeon a man named Maurice LaRue? Yes, Delaroche said. How did you know? Because British intelligence was aware of the fact that LaRue did work from time to time for people like you, did you kill him? Delaroche said nothing. He didn't do you any favors, Michael said. You look hideous. I realized that, Delaroche said coldly, and I blame you. You're a murderer. I don't feel sorry for you because you had a bad experience with a plastic surgeon. I'm not a murderer. I'm an assassin. There's a difference. I used to kill people for my country, but now my country no longer exists, so I kill for money. That makes you a murderer in my book. Are you telling me that such men don't work for your organization? You have your assassins too, Michael, so please, don't try to claim the moral high ground. Who hired you to kill Douglas Cannon? Where are you taking me? Somewhere safe. You're not taking me to a CIA safe house, I hope. Who hired you to kill Douglas Cannon? Delaroche looked out the window for a while, and then drew a deep breath, as if he were about to dive beneath the surface and remain there for a long time. Perhaps I should start from the beginning, Delaroche said finally. He turned from the window and looked at Michael. Be patient, and I'll tell you everything you want to know. Delaroche spoke as if he were reciting the story of someone else's life instead of his own. When he struggled with English, he would switch to one of the other languages he and Michael had in common, Spanish or Italian or Arabic. Not 2 hours before, he had coldly murdered 2 DSS agents.
Yet as far as Michael could tell, he suffered no after effects from the act of killing. Michael had killed only once, a Sword of Gaza terrorist at Heathrow Airport, and he had been haunted by nightmares for weeks. He told Michael about the man he knew only as Vladimir. They had lived in a large KGB flat in Moscow and had a pleasant dacha not far from the city for weekends and holidays. Delaroche was known then by his Christian name, which was Nikolai, and his patronymic, which was Mikhailovich. He was allowed no contact with other children. He did not attend normal state schools. He did not belong to any sports clubs or party youth organizations. He was never permitted to leave the flat or the dacha without Vladimir at his side. Sometimes, when Vladimir was ill or too tired, he would send an unsmiling goon named Boris to accompany the child. Eventually, Vladimir began to teach him languages. "To have another language is to have another soul," Vladimir would say. "And for the life that you are about to lead, Nikolai Mikhailovich, you will need many souls indeed." Delaroche wrinkled his face like an old man and hunched his shoulders. Michael, watching him, marveled at his ability to transform himself into someone else. When he spoke in the voice of Vladimir, he sounded like a Russian for the first time. "Sometimes a tall, dour man with Western suits and Western cigarettes would visit," Delaroche continued. "He would study the young boy as a sculptor might study a work in progress. Many years later, Delaroche would learn the identity of the tall man. He was Mikhail Vorontsov, the head of the first chief directorate of the KGB. His father. In August 1968, at the age of 16, he was sent to the West. He crossed into Austria from Czechoslovakia, posing as the child of Czech dissidents fleeing the Russians. He stayed in Austria for a time, then moved on to Paris, where he lived as a homeless street urchin until the church took him in. It was in Paris that he discovered he could paint. Vladimir had never permitted him to pursue anything but languages and tradecraft. "There isn't time for frivolous pursuits, Nikolai Mikhailovich," he would say. "We are racing against the clock." He would spend afternoons drifting through the museums, studying great works. He attended art school for a time, and even managed to sell a few of his works on the street. Then the man named Mikhail Arbatov appeared, and the killing began. "Arbatov was my control officer," Delaroche said. "At first I handled internal matters, dissidents, potential defectors, that sort of thing. Then I took on a different kind of mission." Michael ticked off a series of assassinations that he knew Delaroche had carried out: the Spanish minister in Madrid, the French police official in Paris, the BMW executive in Frankfurt, the PLO official in Tunis, the Israeli businessman in London. The KGB wanted to take advantage of the terrorist and nationalist movements inside the borders of the NATO alliance and its allies, Delaroche said. The IRA, the Red Army faction, the Red Brigades of Italy, the Basques in Spain, direct action in France, and so on. I killed on both sides of the divide, simply in order to create disorder. There are many more killings than the ones you've named, of course. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, Arbatov and I were set adrift. So you went into private practice? Delaroche nodded, rubbing his ankle. Arbatov had excellent contacts and was a skilled negotiator. He served as my agent, entertaining offers, negotiating fees, that sort of thing. We split the proceeds of my work. And then Transatlantic came along. It was the biggest single payday of my life, $1 million. But I did not shoot down that jetliner. It was that Palestinian psychopath, Hassan Mahmoud, who shot down the plane. You just disposed of Mahmoud. That's right. And the body was left behind, so we would conclude that the Sword of Gaza had carried out the attack. Yes. And then you were hired by the men who really shot down the jetliner to eliminate the other people involved in the operation, like Colin Yardley in London and Eric Stoltenberg in Cairo. And then you. Who hired you? Michael said. Who hired you to kill me?
This ends Disc 9.